you're talking about ultimate significance for the soul, since he's a psychologist, I would say its ultimate object is God, the divine, ultimate reality, whatever we call it. He's, even if we're not talking about a personal God, I mean, he's certainly not encouraging people to meditate on these notions. At least not for what I said. I mean, it's providing the context for his narratives.
Mm-hmm.
The Judeo-Christian, worldview, but I felt nothing in him that, brings me to suspect he would try to lead people to familiarize themselves with the divine. And there's nothing in there.
By taking entheogens, because he keeps referring to that.
By taking what? Entheogens, okay.
Yeah, which is very suspect in itself. I mean, it's definitely not one thing or the other, you know, with Peterson, because certainly engaging by his fruit, and his fruit includes the way that he's affecting people. And I do think that this is one of the most difficult questions, because there are these hundreds of, perhaps tens of thousands of mostly men who feel that he's set them on the straight and narrow, that he's had an incalculably positive effect on their lives, and including ones who have converted to Christianity due to his influence. Like, I don't know how many there are, obviously, but I mean, I don't even know what the ballpark is, but probably, again, hundreds at least. So it's not as though he's not opening people up to spiritual values, like true spiritual values. But I still would say that the degree to which that is really going to carry those people through the, you know, the squalls and the tempests of a true spiritual journey, a true hero's journey, which isn't like the pagan hero journey that he and Campbell, and it's not like that, I don't think. And it has that aspect, but that's the first phase. But the second, but there's another phase which is not, doesn't seem heroic at all. It's just very mundane and grueling. But if Peterson, the degree to which what he's giving these people, will see them through that, I think is contingent on the degree to which he's embodying the principles that he's expostulating. So that's why I keep coming back to that. Mm-hmm. Is he embodying truly spiritual values, truly transcendental values, or is he embodying a worldly ideology of success, hierarchies of not contempt, competence, which, by the way, is, he certainly bangs on about a lot, and it's a totally unquestioned hypothesis in terms of competence being a positive, because there's all kinds of competency that are not positive at all. Right?
Competence. What kind of competence does he refer to? Like his competence as a clinical psychologist?
Whatever. He's just about the world, like how well the world works. The Western world is working really, really well because these hierarchies of competence work, as in, you know, the electricity runs and we all have running water and so on. Well, yeah, sure, at that level, but he's extending hierarchies of competence to the whole social system, suggesting that, you know, world leaders are there because of competence, and I suspect they are, but what kind of competence?
Yeah, okay.
He's not questioning that somebody can be, you know, Adolf Hitler was extremely competent. Yeah. No one's going to take that from him. It's neither here nor there to say that they're hierarchies of competence and not hierarchies of power, because people achieve power through competence. So anyway, I mean, that was a more specific point to the general thing. It was like his advocation of the worldly system that he is successful within and helping others to become more functioning within, is, I would say, not really based in a very deep understanding of the world.
No, I don't think so. I think he's just a successful academic. I mean, certainly, I mean, he's sincere in his, battle against, all these aberrations. He said himself that he's not really a religious person, right? I mean, he said he doesn't go to church.
He goes back and forth on that one. People think he's religious, though. I mean,
then there's also the question, you said that people were converting to Christianity. What kind of Christianity? Are they practicing Christians? Are they? I mean, I'm not judging because I am not as of yet.
Mm-hmm.
But
me neither.
I mean, you could be nominally Christian and not go to church or go to some kind of church that plays rock music.
Well, but even if they were converting to, I mean, I don't think. I mean, not that it's not relevant, but I don't think one can judge it based on what kind of Christianity. Because I may never convert to Christianity. That doesn't, to my understanding so far, doesn't mean I can't be a true Christian. I don't believe in external things anyway. So then they could be converting to the best kind of Christianity. It wouldn't mean that they were actually discovering a true relationship with that thing, right?
What I meant was that they could call themselves Christian just in order to imitate him, because Adam.
Except he's not a Christian, or we don't know if he's Christian or not.
Yeah, that's big. We don't really know. Yeah. Certainly, he stresses the context, the Judeo-Christian. Not the true worldview, I guess, but some of its contents. He brings them up a lot, and maybe people just, for the sake of completing this journey to incarnate Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, I think that's probably what it is. I think if you're really impacted by somebody, as these people are, and you've tidied up your room and you've learned to put your shoulders back and you've petted the cats and you've basically incorporated all of the 12 rules into your life and you've watched every last video, basically it's like, well, what can I do next? It's like you've got to keep doing stuff to consolidate the new good feeling that you're getting. That's how cults work. They get people to do stuff, yeah. And then people want more and more stuff to do, and that creates a movement. Whether or not Peterson's going to create a movement or not, or whether he has already, it remains open, and perhaps that would be an interesting thing to talk about. I would like to just refer to something you just said, maybe in this context of a possible piece of movement, which is how you said how he's taking on aberrations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that probably is central to Peterson's identity and hence his ministry and any kind of movement that he might generate. It's oppositional, I think. I think he's, because it started as in opposition, and I think he essentially is always, because people are always opposing him, so you can't really blame him, but I think he does tend to focus on the areas of opposition.
The question is, where would he be if he didn't have those, the enemies he fights, right? Where would he be?
Exactly.
And he's thriving off, I was very harsh in my judgment because I was referring to kind of the highest spiritual goal, basically, but he might be doing good in helping this lost generation of young males to, like you said, tidy up their rooms and stuff their parents should have taught them, actually.
Yeah.
He's the father figure.
Yeah.
He might be doing good in that, in a sense, but then, so could have anybody else who just, has their life under control, more or less. I mean, and not everybody's as charismatic a speaker as he is, but
mm-hmm.
And then the question is really, what would he be doing if he didn't have this opposition? Would he? I mean, he might still be lecturing passionately on psychology. I don't know what he did before.
The Peterson I like the best is the Maps of Meaning guy in his classroom, and he's obviously connecting to his students, and he's passionate about this whole system, and it's a good enough system. I'm not a fan of systems per se, certainly not when not in applying them and trying to sort out social or psychological problems as he's doing, but just as a thing for exploring ideas and looking at life and existence in new ways. I think that's great, and that it seemed like he really did have an ability for that. But everything changed with the Bill C-16 thing, and he got catapulted onto the world stage through his YouTube channel, and that was all about opposition. And it seems, because it wasn't when he's just teaching students, there's no, it's not really oppositional. Clearly it was in him, though. Clearly mm-hmm. something was in him that got triggered. And then, as I wrote in one of my articles, he stood up and he said no, and that no resonated, you know, resonated throughout the noosphere, the cybersphere, as the no that thousands of people have been waiting to hear. Actually, it's an interesting theory that I've heard a couple of times now, which is that there may be thousands of professionals who have been suffering under the duress of political correctness and newspeak and doublethink and all the stuff that Peterson has stood up for, and have been afraid to speak up. And they're, it's like with Trump, right? They're the silent supporters when they saw Peterson. So it's not just young men who are having their life sorted out. It could be this, you know, quite large field within academia and the intelligentsia who are actually grateful to Peterson and supporting him silently behind the scenes, including, of course, people who write for mainstream media, because he's certainly getting plenty of coverage.
Yeah.
And that is the kernel of a movement. That's like, you've, on the one hand, you've got this potential, I don't want to use the word army because that's loaded, but this, you know, this body of young male followers. And then, on the other hand, you've got perhaps these quite well-placed establishment figures who are quietly supporting him, then you do have the potential for a political movement. You know, whether it was Peterson himself or whether he simply, you know, made it more visible. And
where did he position himself prior to the election in the States? Was he did he come out in favor of Trump? I don't know.
Well, he wasn't. Actually, the election of Trump was right after he came to prominence, wasn't it?
Oh, so, really?
Yeah,
it was because it was at the time when I discovered him. It was the same. It somehow it was really weird. It all came together. This whole cake, Trump and Peterson thing, but yeah, maybe it was afterwards.
Well, Trump was November and Peterson was September, so it was just a couple of months gap between the thing. And I don't think he came out later saying he would have voted for Trump, but, you know, kind of reluctantly, like he didn't profess to be a fan of Trump, but he just said that he would probably have had to vote for Trump. Yeah, so I mean, it's an area I haven't gone yet with my writing or the podcast, but because I know, you know, that's what the people who really hate Peterson or fear him, they want to go there. They want to compare him to Hitler and so on and so forth, and so, you know, well, they have a history of overreacting, these types, let's say. But I don't think because of that it shouldn't just be, you know, ignored or just disincluded or whatever the word is, you know, like it's dismissed. It's probably a bit early to speculate, although I'd be interested in your thoughts generally as somebody who you know, grew up with that history in your own past. But the thing that interests me specifically is how do we gauge when somebody's a benevolent influence? Like, at what stage can we decide, yes, that's been benevolent? Because if you inspire young men to tidy their rooms and so on, sure, they're going to feel better for a while. I'm sure they're going to straighten out their lice for a while, but as I said, it's got, in order to maintain that high, they either have to follow it through to some inner realization, a connection to their own souls, and then they're off and free, and they kind of forget all about Jordan Peterson, he was just a catalyst, or they've got to just keep reinforcing their allegiance to those principles.
Well, for me, the question would be, I mean, he has written maps of meaning, but does he really provide, he certainly cannot provide meaning, but does he set people on a path, intellectual path, that can lead them towards true meaning? Mm-hmm. Or really just generate people who are striving for worldly goods, who ultimately might, again, at some point they might, again, he might meet one of his followers, I don't know, in a battle for a grand or something, or a speaker.
Mm-hmm.
Will he just generate people who are hungry for the world, or will he open up vistas, that provide true meaning? And there I would have to refer back to, true spirituality, all those things that are really important. Yeah, things that are ultimately the soul's object, which are not worldly goods. I mean, they can help for a while, I don't think that they're really necessary. I mean, I'm not living as a hermit, but I don't think they're really necessary for.
But I mean, his map of meaning is, at its best anyway, is about how to be in the world. And like my own point of view there is that being in the world is the only way to really cease to be of the world. Like, it doesn't work by withdrawing from the world. We have to go all the way into the world and really become integrated with the world in order to get free of that within us that the world has implanted. It's almost as though it's only when we're deeply immersed enough in the world that the world can actually, like a magnet, will draw out what's worldly within us.
So like some kind of purification?
I suppose it is like a purification. Yeah, it is a bit similar to a purification ritual, where there's a sort of duress and kind of initiation aspect, although again it's not, I'd say that it's not like the heroic journey where you battle dragons in the world, but where you allow the world to define you externally rather than being in opposition to the world, which I would say is true also if you're trying to achieve success in the world, you place yourself in opposition to the world essentially, because the world's doing everything to prevent you from being successful, right? That's kind of the nature of it. I mean, it provides the temptations, but it also provides the obstacles. So, what was this in reference to about the worldly path? I just feel that Peterson, he stopped way too soon. Like, he's got this map of meaning, which essentially is partially or primarily a Darwinian interpretation of the world, albeit with Jung and Nietzsche and the Bible thrown in there, but without capsizing the Darwinian sort of foundations. And it describes the way in which we relate to the world as a series of tools and obstacles in order to achieve our goals. Fine. Very true. Kind of profound, but at the same time also kind of obvious. But certainly worth having a deeper understanding of. But to then, it seems as though he's then applied that map in order to overcome the obstacles and develop the tools and get to the treasure, the buried treasure. But the treasure isn't in this world.
Yeah, but see, I think that's not on his radar at all, because like you said it yourself, I mean, he's using the Darwinian framework And that's basically all you have to say there, right? I mean, I'm making it easy, but I started on that book. I know that it was the time when I also, it's actually, it's been very recent, my turning towards Christianity, but it was about the time I already started reading Orthodox literature. And then I came across Peterson's The Map of Meaning, and I started reading it, but I had some, I didn't really, I don't know if I finished the first chapter maybe, but there was something just not satisfying. I didn't feel this, that there was a way he was opening up any vista for higher things, maybe. Mm. And coming back to your question, whether we can say if he's having a malevolent effect maybe on people or in the world. I mean, insofar as he helps people getting self-confident, fair enough, but I think when it comes to taking a traditional Orthodox religious framework and then enclosing it within this shell of Darwinism and mechanistic worldviews, that would be, I don't assume malevolent, but certainly not contributing to spiritual growth, to striving for truth.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you're on your way up and then the Peterson jet, and then, I don't know, he's brings you down again. It's like, get what I mean?
Yes, well, that's my sense too, that he wants to, and maybe has succeeded for some people, to put the transcendental on the map by reducing it to the mundane, essentially, even if it's the clinically psychological and the Jungian, you know, that it has, I mean, it's got the mythical subtext and the context for it, so it appears transcendent, but is it really? I mean, this is what my truck with occultism too, that anything that you can engineer yourself through will, technology, through action, through ritual, is that transcendent? I don't think it is. I think it's back to what you're saying about that God is available to us, and God will move to us, but we can in some sense invite that and allow it to happen, but we can't engineer it. We can't control God.
No, and well, I haven't read the book Maps of Meaning, but isn't the underlying notion that, I mean, yeah, well, the Christian Judeo framework, it's very nice, but in the end, it's we who construct the meaning. I mean, it's we who got the right narrative. Evolution, we somehow, on the track of evolution, we made the best narrative. We, the West.
I think so. I mean, to give the benefit of the doubt again, I've seen Peterson struggling with this when he gets asked about it, and so I think that in part at least, I think because he's geared towards pragmatism, he wants to present a system like a good scientist that's finished, that's tested and tried and proven and that works. And that it can't end on a question mark. It can't end on, well, you know, this is all the data I've gathered, but actually, you know, it's about God the transcendent, all bets are off. I've actually got no clue if any of this is really true, because, you know, once you introduce that element into it, well, human beings, we're just so flawed and finite that we can't know. Well, that's not a scientific, as you're describing in your own career, you can't even talk about those things. So he's gone out on a limb already, like a very long, you know, thin limb, really, just trying to incorporate. I mean, that said, he's just a professor at the University of Toronto, so it wasn't that big a limb. But in terms of being unconventional anyway, just by trying to incorporate fictional narratives and myths and even religion into his scientific model, that does seem superficially quite radical. It's actually not, because it's been done so many times before him. But still,
considering the times we're living in, and the climate in academia, then
yeah,
you can say it's quite radical.
Yeah. I mean, it's. But then again, you know, this isn't what he's got attention for.
No.
It's interesting, you know, that this is why I focused on his maps of meaning for the first part, for the last two essays I did, because that seems to be, A, what's probably more interesting, what Peterson has to contribute more is in that material, even if I agree with you, I don't think it's particularly deep, but I do think it's relevant. And B, because other people aren't talking about him. I mean, you know, in the articles that praise him and the articles that damn him, they don't really refer to his actual, you know, his presentation, the thing that he's presenting to the world. It's more about the ways he's confronting and opposing the dominant ideology once again, and that's the thing that makes him heroic to some and demonic to others. So it's polarizing. But is that, I mean, certainly that's a separate question, and you know, whether those maps of meaning are truly useful or not. Obviously his really devoted followers, they're going to cling to that like a life raft, so that's very significant in and of itself as a question. But it's sort of somewhat separate from the question of, you know, what kind of good is Peterson doing in the world by being the guy who stands up to political correctness and says no? Because again, that could seem like a positive thing to begin with, but it's an example. Okay, so now we know we can say no. But they said this about Donald Trump too. The reason you know, people felt such relief about Donald Trump, even some people didn't like him perhaps, but a big part of it was safe to be politically incorrect suddenly. Well, now we have a president who's politically incorrect. So, but I can appreciate Trump for that, as in he breaks the mold, so at least the narrative's a bit more interesting, but I can't equate it with some sort of really truly meaningful social change or transformation. It just seems like the narrative just keeps reinventing itself, and you know, like a TV series that keeps on going, it's got to come up with twists, otherwise people stop watching. One thing I have kept coming back to, which is about Peterson that's good, is that it opens up the discussion. So now more people are talking about more meaningful things because of Peterson, for a while anyway.
But then for me, the question again would be, are they talking, do they, like after reading him or listening to him, do they have a notion of there being meaning within things, within actual things in the world? Like, you know, does the structure of the world somehow, or the beings in the world, do they carry meaning, or do they now have this, we in the Christian West, we've just come up with the best narrative, which can subjectively in our heads, our brains, provide us with meaning, because that's what he's going back to, right? I mean, ultimately, Peterson would say that the brain generates meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Generates, really. I mean, I'm not saying that it receives, like, the, of course, the senses receive impressions from the world, and the brain is important, but there's something else than saying, as I would think he would say, the brain is what actually generates meaning for the subject. And that's all there is in terms of meaning. And then the subject can write a book and the meaning gets carried on. But ultimately, I would like to hear him answer the question whether he thinks the world is meaningful. I mean, I don't know, maybe he already has. Then he probably would oscillate back and forth.
Oh, he'd give you a 20-minute answer, which was his whole model. Because this whole model is about that, but it, well, I don't think we can reasonably expect, or even why would we desire, you know, simple answers from Peterson about the nature of reality or even his point of view about it. I think he's most admirable and when he's most honest and he's saying, I don't know, like when he's asked about the incarnation, he doesn't know. And maybe that's true, or maybe he's just not wanting to alienate anyone, but, you know, so he's sitting on the fence. I suspect he genuinely is wrestling with these questions of ultimate meaning. But I also think it's going to get harder and harder for him to be in that liminal space of admitting that he doesn't know. Because if you're, you know, on the world stage and you're constantly being attacked and opposed and challenged, well, you can't just stand there and think and, you know, wonder and, well, I wonder if, you know, that's a completely adverse sort of environment to that. And but he's asked for that. Like, he's invited that, and he's taken on the role of somebody who is embodying or mirroring great cultural currents.
My prediction would be that he's gonna stay on this wave, or he's gonna ride the current. This, like, opposing political correctness and all of that. But I don't think a system can ultimately provide much satisfaction. Actually, I don't think a system can provide true meaning. I mean, it can provide you with a narrative of how people, with a narrative of the narrative, how people can, you know, manufacture meaning for themselves, but it's not graspable. Like, for the intellect or the soul, what have you. It's not really, it's just the feeling I got when I read his book, it was something substantially missing for me in terms of, true meaning. I mean, for me, maybe it's because I studied psychology, it smelled of this subjectivist notion of meaning, and that's all in our heads.
Have you read René Girard or listened to him?
I went my last year at university. I had some theology course there. The guy talked about him. I read an article on, it was on mythology as well. Like, so I know the mimetic theory, and that's what I know him for, basically.
Well, you know, I don't know how fair it is as a counterpoint to Peterson. I think it's reasonably fair as a contrast. To me, Girard, who just died, unfortunately, I think he lived to be 90. I think he's a reasonable contrast to Peterson because he's somebody who, he did achieve some recognition in the last period of his life, maybe in his 70s or 80s. Or I think he had peer recognition earlier than that, but he got recognition for having formulated an interpretation of the Bible and of society and of human behavior that was truly surprising, truly transformative, I would say, speaking personally, that once understood, or to the extent that it is understood, because I still don't fully understand it, it changed the way that I look at myself, the world, and certainly the Bible. Like, I wouldn't have got as close to Christianity as quickly as I have in the last few years without Girard.
Are you referring to this theory of my mimesis or mimetics?
Yes, but it's more than that. It's the scapegoat mechanism and how the gospel reveals the scapegoat mechanism.
And in Girard, did you get the idea that he's talking about, like, the way it was presented to me? Because I haven't read the book, unfortunately, so I probably got a very superficial presentation. But the scapegoat mechanism, there again, I wasn't sure. Is there something like personal evil, or is it all again made up by people like these?
Well, he converted to Catholicism in his final years, so
yeah.
I don't know how much. And that, to me, is more significant, you know, whether or not he incorporated that into his interpretation. It's like you were saying about Peterson, when you read Map's Meaning or tried to, you didn't get that feeling that there was something deeper there. Well, with Girard, you do. There's something deeper at work there. And it led Girard to, I mean, not to say just because he converted to Catholicism means he was, that's not necessarily a positive thing. There's plenty of Catholics, but in his case, I suspect it was, although initially I viewed that with skepticism, because I was quite anti-Christian until recently. But my sense now is that the things he discovered through his analysis of literature and his investigation of social psychology and so on and so forth, that and his reading of the gospel led him to understand, in a way, the literal truth of the Bible, although not meant in the way that obviously the fundamentalists mean it, but as in that it literally represents a system by which one can be saved. Not a system, but an understanding, or run out of words there, but it helped me to understand that the gospel actually does reveal something through its structure, through its text, through the words that are transmitting Christ's words, that is the solution to mimetic rivalry, to violence, social contagion, mimetic violence, and the scapegoating. The way that society coheres and binds itself together through violence. And that eventually,
which one was it?
Which what?
The book?
I just have a Girard reader. So Violence and the Sacred was the first one. I'm not sure if it's all contained in there. But, you know, honestly, it's mostly I just got through listening to Girard, because there's a series of lectures he did. His thing is very simple, but it's very hard to understand. Like, there's just a few moving parts, but they're just very, very profound. So you can definitely hear it all summed up in an hour or something like that, but then it might took me a year or 2 years or something to really process it and figure out what he was talking about, because it was just so new, such a new way of interpreting. And because it extended into everything, really. Like, okay, now as I understand, well, this is true, so this, it's not like it explains everything. Obviously it doesn't explain, you know, why caterpillars eat the cabbages and stuff, but I mean that it's a lens that through which everything, you know, about human interactions anyway, can be seen and better understood, I think. Because it plays out in every sort of human interaction. And Peterson's aiming for something like that, definitely. But he's not introducing anything radically new, I don't think.
No.
He's just rearranging data. He hasn't had a sort of vision. Not that Girard claimed to have had a vision, but Girard, I think, immersed himself so deeply into the process of exploration that he discovered something that had not been discovered, and then he was able to articulate, bring it forth. Whereas Peterson, I think, is working more on the surface as an academic, and he's created a sort of machinery or a technology and a ministry through which he can establish himself in the world, and he's certainly been successful at that. But that makes me suspicious in and of itself, that the most obvious fruit of all of his research is him becoming a massive celebrity.
Yeah, and also carrying on this opposition. I mean, of course, there's always instances in life where you have to stand up for yourself or for others, even better, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe oppose others. But I don't know. It just, you know, it's a vague notion I have, but the way he's been carrying it on now, the past 2 years, I guess, or maybe three years. Yeah, there's something in it. This is just strive.
Striving, yeah. Well, I think he has a mission, and I wouldn't say that about Girard. I was going to say, you know, anyone that I really feel that I've benefited from their work, but that might be a bit of a stretch because I'd have to go through a lot of people there. But I think generally the people who provide really fresh fruit that will be nourished by, they're not concerned with changing the world, you know, or causing big impact or affecting millions of people. They're trying to work something out, and that takes up most of their energy and attention. And yeah, if they have some sort of platform, they become public speakers and so on, fine. I mean, that's obviously a valuable way to communicate, but it would have to be also part of their continued exploration. They couldn't just say, well, I've got it, my model now, and I'm just going to go and start knocking on doors and selling it, right? So that means it'd have to be dialogues. And Peterson claims that he's doing dialogues, and to a certain extent he even is. He does interviews and so on, but he also does these massive presentations with thousands of people, and obviously, you know, his internet presence is a platform, you know, with just this invisible audience. And you know, he gave up being a psychologist because he didn't have time after becoming a celebrity. And I'd say that sort of represents, or that's, I mean, yeah, it symbolizes, but it's also a literal example of him making a choice between one-to-one, soul-to-soul, connecting dialogues where real change can happen, and having a platform and reaching as many people as he can where social change can appear to be happening, but is it? Is it real change? You know, are people really changed if they find some figure to look up to and imitate them? History doesn't have very good stories to tell about that.
No. I mean, I'm short-sighted there. I don't see him as inherently dangerous, as in that he might potentially generate some, you know, a force, somehow draw even more numbers of people to him who might, I don't know, go off to the extreme right. I mean, really to the extreme right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what he says. He opposes, I don't even know, does he oppose transgender people? I mean,
no.
True transgender, no, right?
He opposes polygamy. I mean, I'd say he opposes some of the right things, but the problem is, I mean, let's say, I use this obvious example where he's put his foot in it with the New York Times about the enforced monogamy. Although I think it doesn't seem it's damaged his reputation too much, and he seems to have managed to negotiate it his way through it. But the thing is, that's an example of him making, I think, a reasonably good point, but him extrapolating from it social policy, at which point it becomes a really bad idea. And I'd say that's always true. Like, as soon as you try and turn truths into social policy, they get distorted on their way. I mean, even just through human error, but they also, by human malevolence, will also make sure that every good truth gets converted into a pernicious lie along the way to being implemented. Like the Fabian Society, you know, a shining example of that. So again, his naivety about the way of the world there is sort of in showing itself in very stark terms, but also the potential danger. Like, I think when this thing about liminal times, which he's riding that wave of people not knowing what's real and what's false, and who's a man and who's a woman, and which bathroom I can use, and so on, and they're desperate. Of course, more and more desperate for somebody to tell them where the ground is. And so then that person shows up and says, a man's a man and a woman's a woman, and then it is like a straw for drowning people. And I don't know if Peterson's intention is going to be much of a, you know, determinant of just how his appeal might affect people in terms of, I mean, if there is a general collective shift towards more extreme imposition of social order because of all the chaos that's been engendered through runaway progressive politics, then Peterson, and he wouldn't be responsible for this, but he might actually be riding that wave and not know it.
Yeah, he's vulnerable to, he has a technocratic leaning, right? I mean,
yeah.
In a way, he'd be vulnerable to that, and yeah. And, I mean, maybe he could be, wasn't he described as this, a doorway to whatever, Christianity?
Gateway drug to Christianity or the alt-right or both, yeah.
Gateway drug to ultimate acceptance of the technocratic state. I don't know. I mean, he said like how he's presenting his use of antidepressants. It's very that's the same. This technocratic mindset. Like, I take a mild dose of antidepressants, explaining what it does perfectly. And I think the case for antidepressants. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, well, you get no argument from me there, obviously, because I've made a similar one. And I think the point about sort of shoehorning the technocracy into place is on point, I would say, when it comes to Peterson. And I think that he might even admit it, but obviously not if it was put to him in that context. But he wants to stabilize society, and that suggests to me, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. We don't want people tearing each other apart. But there's an implicit assumption in that, which is in his also in his opposition to the left, sort of, you know, the leftist view of patriarchy and all that. The implicit assumption is that if we can stabilize society, then we can continue on its course, and things will keep getting better. And that's his assumption, that things have been getting better until the damn cultural Marxists ruined it, right? And the postmodernists. Well, but society's been on the course to the technocratic, you know, world state for at least 100 years. And unfortunately, you kind of have to be a conspiracy theorist to know this, or at least get painted as one to talk about it. But that's just not true. It's not theoretical. There's all of this literature out there, from H.G. Wells to Changing Images of Man and so on. I don't know, there's a whole list of books where, you know, one can actually see that this Bertrand Russell, Scientific Outlook, that this, you know, technocracy has been in the planning stages for decades and decades now, and it's proceeding according to plan. So that's apparently what Peterson wants, whether he knows it or not.
I that's something I think when you went through academic training as a psychologist, you're first of all, you're mentally vulnerable to it, because the whole training is geared towards that. And the second thing is, usually you're an agent of the technocracy. I mean, you're, as a psychologist, in more than, I would say, 70% of cases, at least in Europe, you're employed by the state, and you're employed in positions where mostly your task is to explain to people why they have to lead their lives in such and such ways, which is usually in conformity with how the state, and by extension, the elites, want you to lead with your life. Let me think of an example. Someone loses their job and goes, I don't know, you know, loses all meaning and doesn't see meaning in life, goes to a therapist. And the therapist's job is basically then to get him on the job again. Which is not bad, of course. It's not bad. Yeah. Work can be meaningful and, but, and in the way I've experienced it in these mental health settings, it's just, yeah, you always have this smell of the technocracy. You're an agent of the state who has to fix people and get them back to work, and especially prevent them from questioning some underlying assumptions, the worldview. And I would say actually actively narrowing down their perception of the world. I mean, that's what the psychologist in Brave New World does, right? In the end, I mean, it boils down to that.
Right.
And yeah, that's something I can see in Peterson.
Yes. So, and again, it's, I don't know how much of it is naivety and how much of it is something else. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you expecting him to be in the know, so to speak, or?
Well, of course, that can't be ruled out.
Yeah.
He's certainly a very good. If he were a lifetime actor, he's a very good one. I mean, better than Timothy Leary, I say. Or he really does seem quite sincere. But it wouldn't have to be... I don't think it's that much of a polarity, as in a completely sincere individual versus a, you know, a Machiavellian deceiver. I think there's this very wide spectrum in between conscious and unconscious behavior. Yeah, I mean, I'm reluctant to speculate, particularly at this kind of late hour. It must be very late for you over there.
No, we don't have to speculate on it. I was just wondering.
I just wish that Peterson... and I think it's highly unlikely now, but that he would look at some data that would really undermine his whole frickin' thesis. So, including perhaps especially the data such as that, I don't know, that book, that Solzhenitsyn book that guy tried to, or gave him at a lecture, and when Peterson wouldn't answer about the Jews. I'm not about the Jews, but certainly... data that you know indicates that the leftist condemnation of the so-called patriarchy as being just a system of hierarchical power abuses is not without merit. Like, they may have pointed at the wrong areas and they may have got the diagnosis really quite wrong, so it makes it easy for someone like Peterson to dismiss it as ideological sophistry and so on, or sentimentality or whatever else. But there's plenty of other data out there, as it seems like you know, it seems like you're familiar with it, I guess if you've been following Branko, that the superstructure of the Western state is inherently abusive, exploitative, corrupt, destructive, And you don't have to dig that deep to find the evidence. You just have to really want to go there and see it. And he doesn't. And he particularly wouldn't now because he's busy trying to restore, you know, this social structure to its former glory.
I could believe it. Maybe, to be honest, it's again very presumptuous, but in a way, because I think I know the mind of the psychologist in Peterson. I mean, there's more certainly, but that just, if you take seriously what you study there, it's and the underlying assumptions, you have to be quite naive, I would say. Certainly, I was quite naive. I probably still am, but I was very naive while I was studying psychology in the first years after graduate. So, sometimes some of the videos, not where he talks, not where he presented talks, but where he answers these listeners' questions, which are usually about therapy and how do I boost my personality, seems very naive. Concerning what you said, I could imagine that he longs for a restoral, because there is a lot of beauty in the, you know, of course, in the Western tradition, I would say, right? And he refers back to that.
Mm-hmm.
I would suspect he has a romantic longing to restore some. He probably is just a vague notion, and totally closes his eyes to the malevolent superstructure which is now sitting on top,
mm-hmm.
basically of the Western world. That's what I think. I mean, I think he's genuine. I mean, insofar as he's longing for, you know, true values and all of that, he's probably exploiting his privileged position like anybody else would, like, as in, you know, so maybe exploiting some of his power as a professor, like what everybody does. He can fire someone, gets to choose who to hire in a way. He might enjoy making use of that power, but I don't think he's conscious of playing into the hands of, you know, the overlords, potentially.
Uh-huh.
We're not sure yet whether he certainly can be used for that.
En tiedä kuinka kauan, on le yaelodan dai misson mahalun laske juuret maahan hyvän ja kasvaa.
So either, and it's perhaps not. It's certainly not the only way to look at it, and to look at Peterson himself. I mean, and he does seem to uphold admirable values a lot of the time, even most of the time, despite what those who hate him think. Obviously, I think the opposite, but. I mean, I'm definitely traditionally oriented myself. I do think that in many ways, you know, we had a much better sense of what values were 100 years ago or 200 years ago. But of course, there were all these other circumstances that one can't leave out of that. Even if one could go back to that time, one would find that there were all kinds of other problems, right? There was slavery, for one thing, you know. There's all kinds of examples that, and some of which we just have decided are bad but might not be, and others that we write about, but we can't really separate them out. Like, I mean, this is the thing, is when a species is confronting its own pathology, it's you can't stop halfway and say, oh, and we've got to backtrack. That's like the psychoanalytical process. It gets worse long before it gets better, and with no guarantee that it's ever going to get better, I think, I would say. I mean, yeah, there are indications that it is getting better while it's getting worse, but there's no guarantee that one's going to go all the way through into one's trauma, into one's distortions, and come out completely whole. Just as there's no guarantee that if one orientates oneself towards the highest good, as Peterson puts it, that the good will respond, that God will, you know, intervene in our lives. There simply isn't. It's so far beyond what we are capable of conceiving of. So, this is what I've said before. He's not. He pays lip service to Nietzsche and Jung. But he doesn't walk that particular talk. He's not willing to really plunge into the darkness.
No, I don't think so, no. Because I was going to say, when you just contrasted these two, like the going up and the other one, like going in, or the second one, you cannot expect to God to respond, but I'd say in general it's probably less dangerous than, you know,
than what?
For example, the Jungian or psychoanalytic endeavor in general. Although I have to say, you'd know more about it than me.
Well, I can't separate them, but obviously in my own life I can't. But I mean, I do think there are people who can simply live a life of faith and grace, absolutely. But I'm not one of those people, and I never will be. Like, my intellect is very developed, and for me, I think for people like me, there's no way around psychology. And all I see so many people who don't including people who are going to religion, like I would say prematurely, without having done the psychological work, in quotes. I don't think you can bypass it. I also don't think it's like we can do all the work ourselves. I think it's like the myths, you know, where the heroine or the hero, it's usually a heroine actually, has to perform some impossible task, and she is incapable of doing it, but she can't avoid doing it because she's doomed if she doesn't do it. So she, I don't know if she embarks or she is overwhelmed by despair, but whatever, she confronts the reality of this impossible task, because either way she's confronting it, even if it overwhelms her, and then something intervenes and completes the task for her. I think we have to approach the infinite, we have to approach the impossible, the darkness, and be willing to go all the way into it, even if we know that we can't. It's like we can't say, well, I figured out, you know, by extrapolation what's in the darkness, so I don't have to go there, because I've more or less, look, I've got a map of what's probably in the darkness. It's 99% statistically accurate, so that's fine. That's the thing I'm saying that people want to bypass.
I only see the danger in the like plunging into the darkness within. I see the danger. That's the way I see it now. If you totally rely on yourself, and there, you know, you have no notion of, no sentiment of there being some higher influence which might watch over you, and to whom you might have to listen, in a way.
Yeah, well, isn't that, I mean, from the point of view of our ego mind that might even think it could do it for itself and be deluded and so on, that isn't that higher power the soul?
I would say that,
the intermediary? The intermediary between us and God, like as I say, in our flawed selves.
Does there have to be an intermediary?
I think so. Yeah. I think so, because how do you approach the infinite directly?
And I would say maybe the soul mirrors God, mirrors the divine.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, that this might be, but that's belief, of course. But my belief that there is this this unbridgeable distance, like, doesn't have to be, you know, particularly big in spatial terms, but just this ontological distance which you cannot really, which depends on God, the divine, ultimate reality, to reach out to you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because, you know, being a medium, it would require me to think in spatial terms. And thinking in spatial terms there, at least for me, that would not make it difficult to leave space for true spirit. Leave space.
Perhaps, but reaching out implies space too.
True enough, yeah.
I mean, I don't mean that the soul is synonymous with God, but my sense is that the soul is with God, always.
With God.
The soul is always with God, and therefore, if we can respond, if we can be open to the soul reaching out to us, to our own soul reaching out to us, then that, we are being touched by God through our own souls, something like that. It's quite poetic, but my sense is that the soul itself is transcendent, therefore.
And who's the we? The we is the ego?
Yes, as in our mind, so, you know, our fallen selves that is being rescued or saved.
Oh.
So there's something for me, but where I say the psychological process is can't be bypassed, even though I'm not saying you've got to, like, same I'd say with Christianity, I don't believe you have to do the steps or anything, but I think we have to go through some sort of process that like I was sure I knew what I wanted to say there, but now I'm not entirely sure. It's like putting our attention directing our attention to I suppose perhaps it's simply the gulf, like
the gulf between
us and our own souls. Like it's, we can't, like you said, it's not spatial or temporal, so we can't build a bridge to our soul. We can't actually do anything, but we can stop doing things that are maintaining the gulf or maintaining the distraction from the gulf. Like we keep trying to fill the hole. And you can't fill the gulf, so you just keep on. You can spend your whole life trying to fill it. So the thing is, can we stop trying to fill the hole, or even trying to bridge it? It could be through spiritual practices, could be the subterfuge. And then, can we just put our attention, instead of putting our attention on all these subterfuges that try and bridge the gulf or fill the hole, can we just put our attention on the gulf and feel the longing and the pain of being separate from our own souls?
And then giving into that,
and then
that might carry you.
Giving into it. I mean, just letting it exist, letting ourselves feel it. That would be affect too. Like it's in our bodies and everything. You know, that estrangement, and I think that the soul responds to that. The soul. It's like the soul is always there, trying to reach us anyway. But we're not putting our attention, and so our attention has to go for our attention to go to our soul, it has to go on the gulf between ourselves, and that's the most painful experience, I'd say. And that, so that's why I say the cycle, you can't bypass that, I don't think. I mean, you can't ever say can't, because God's grace, you know, if God is God, he can bless anyone at any time.
Yeah.
But so yeah, you could say, well, maybe I'll get blessed without. But that's kind of back to that same thing: is you have to have a morality. And to me, psychology is morality. Psychology is about we are accountable for our actions, just as we are imprinted and traumatized by the actions of others. It's all about the accountability of all of us.
But then you would say that the soul is always with God. The soul cannot really be damaged or stained in any way. It would be more our egos that would bring, I don't know, damage upon themselves and thereby lose connection to the soul.
Well, I think this is where we get to this weird thing with the psyche not being quite the soul, like the psyche being the soul in time. And I think the psyche does get imprinted, and that, so that can extend to damage, and that psyche has to be healed in order to be fully, to return to its oneness with the soul and with God, and that it will take scars with it. And I think there is something about, even though God's eternal, the incarnation changes eternity. And I don't know how to, you know, that's like my logical faculties break down at that point. But something's happening. I mean, otherwise, I don't know. I mean, it's like there's a purpose for our incarnation that only God knows. But presumably, our experience, where if we return to God, our experience goes with us, presumably in some form. Otherwise, it would be as if it never happened. And then what would be the point, right? So, if our experience goes with us, that would be like a kind of scarring, I think, or an imprinting on the psyche, and that, I think, in that sense, you'd say that it's more than just the ego that gets stained. I think there are consequences, you know, for our souls, right?
Yeah, as in the soul being, I don't know, when it finally comes to meet God and it carries this psychic staining or scars, whatever, that it might not be able to behold the true light.
If it's a mirror, it's like it's the psyche meets the soul even before the meeting God. You said the soul's a mirror. I'd say the soul's a mirror for God, but the soul's also a mirror for the psyche. So we see, you know, in the moment that we're returning to God, we see the true nature of our existence and our true accountability. And if that's too much, we would withdraw from the union.
The idea of the soul, the psyche and the soul being not the same, you worked it out yourself, or did you get it from somewhere?
Well, just because that's the etymology. Psyche just means soul in Greek, so you can't rule that, ignore that entirely, right?
No, but but you're saying that the psyche is not the soul.
Well, that's
entirely.
No, that's just an intuitive thing, and
okay.
Like, as I said, that it seems like there's a necessary hierarchy, as you put it. If we're talking about something eternal incarnating in the temporal, then also, I mean, we're getting really deep now, but I'm not sure that the soul is individual. I'm not sure if there's any real individuality to the soul.
So that'd be more like more of an Eastern spin, talking about the traditional religions, more Atman, or I don't really know what it is.
I don't really know it either, and I wonder if it isn't in Orthodox Christianity too. As I say, because if humanity is emerged collectively with Christ, then there's, where would be the individual souls in that?
How do you mean? If Christianity,
isn't that the Christian doctrine, that humanity, if it's to be saved, or insofar as it is saved, it's the bride of Christ, and it becomes wed to Christ collectively.
Mm-hmm.
So then couldn't have any stragglers. Then it would just be this one.
I see what you mean. We'd probably need a philosopher or theologian,
a professional to come in and sort us out. Yeah. I don't know. I think there's. I mean, it's largely intuitive. There's some amount of logic in there, but I think, for me, once we start talking about soul, I'm getting into areas of, I guess, the communion again, the community of saints, but of a collective, of a shared existence. Like, one can't be isolate as a soul. That's damnation.
Yeah, I see. I still retain the concept of the individual soul that can be in communion with all the other souls in heaven, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I would retain the individuality, but it's the belief.
Yeah, well, same here, but I'd say that. I mean, I certainly used to believe more what you described, and I now associate that with Carlos Castaneda and Gnosticism and occultism, which is about the ipsissimus and the macabre and the monad soul, and this whole idea that we can become, you know, immortal beings, sort of whizzing around the universe like the Silver Surfer, basically containing, you know, all the knowledge of God, that we become God while at the same time having these individual existences. And based on my experience living in this body, the process seems to be the opposite. It seems to be about letting the barriers and obstacles between oneself and one's environment and one other human beings just dissolve until one essentially has no defenses and no no opposition and no hostility. One is embracing everything and being embraced by everything, and that is ultimately terrifying to the ego, but I think it's what the soul wants.
Maybe there's some sort of divine paradox there. Like, somewhere I read this, in heaven you are in total communion, while, I don't know, order is retained or something like that, or individuality is retained while keeping total communion. And in hell it would be, it would be all one chaotic mix, but still, but no essential communion.
No togetherness, yeah. Yeah, it sounds...
Because, I mean, you can be with people and alone, right? But just everyday experience.
Well, it's like, as physical bodies, one can... I don't know if you've read or listened to any of my stuff about Dave Ashana, but he's an enlightenment claimant in Finland, mm-hmm. I spent time with, and my impression of him is that he's very much in tune with the connections that are constant between himself and myself and those around him, and that he certainly said this, that he doesn't experience himself as separate from other human beings. But he's very individual, and he's very physical, and he's got a very strong, clear personality. So it's clear that if such a state is true, and if it's possible and attainable to us, we would still experience ourselves and have an awareness of being a physical body, so we could still see a sort of theoretical separation. But at a deeper level, there would be no way to actually deny or avoid the interconnectivity of all of us, and so that is both. But I think it depends on the dissolving of these internal structures of identity and just being left with the God-given identity. You are an image of God, I am an image of God, and each image is unique. They're not all the same image, because God is infinite. There's no end to the images, but all those images together is Christ, which is the Son of Man. And, well, who knows? I mean, I don't know beyond that, but there is always an inherent paradox in Christian doctrine.
Yeah.
And that was my, originally, for a long time, that was my resistance to it, but it's becoming, in a way, its attraction, because I think if you can actually allow a paradox to exist and not be... compelled to take one side or another, then that allows for transcendence of the mind self, which is everything is either or. Like that is illusory in itself. Back to bodies, like if bodies experience themselves as interconnected, who are we to say differently? Yeah, because they're experiencing both. The body obviously has to survive, so it treats itself as an individual, but it may also experience itself as part of a collective and an ecosystem, and that's also part of its survival. And that's not a paradox. It's only a paradox to the mind.
Mm. Well, for me, I know what kept me from approaching traditional religion, any sort of religion actually, was this really this technocratic mindset, and certainly this allowing for paradoxes to exist. It only became possible for me after breaking down these assumptions and, you know, this view of the world as a closed system, totally mechanistic. That doesn't really allow for any paradoxes to exist. Although, in actual fact, I mean, this worldview is full of paradoxes in itself, but.
Yeah. It is, but I think they tend to be, I mean, like there's paradoxes in quantum mechanics, but they're so abstract.
Yeah.
That they don't really offend people, I think.
Yeah.
I found the Christian paradoxes offensive. There are some I still do, like hell. eternal damnation I find offensive to my sensibilities.
Yeah, I noticed when I listened to one of your recent talks. So, yeah, I mean, I don't find it. I certainly don't like it. Somehow I can somehow accept it, but I certainly don't like it.
I can't. I don't think Christ would accept it. I think that's the meaning of a big central to the meaning of Christ is he goes after the lost sheep. I don't think he would leave any man behind. So
maybe we'll know.
Well, I mean, apparently this is, I mean, Jonathan Page said the same, apparently this is part of orthodoxy. They say hell, Christ emptied hell. And also Charles Upton said that Christian view that we know hell exists, we don't know if anyone's there or not. So it's like, well, it's, yeah.
But the Christian orthodoxy, does it say, I thought it was just referred to he emptied hell when he went down to Hades.
Yeah. So maybe it got filled up again after that. But the point is it wasn't eternal. I'm okay with the notion of hell, but just not forever.
Yeah. Well, I cannot venture into this territory at that hour. But one thing, you know, this guy, Carl Stern, because that's a psychoanalyst who also turned Christian. It's a one of a kind. I never really, and I think really orthodox in a way, might be interested. One of his books was on archive.org for free.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the title. I can send it to you. That might be interesting for you because he's both. I read his book. It was on psychoanalysis within how it can be reconciled with the how it might be reconciled with a Christian worldview. And he seems to be, from my estimation, I don't know. He seems to be fairly orthodox as concerns religion. I cannot really judge, and pretty orthodox in terms of psychoanalysis as well. Which is truly a paradox.
Yeah. Yeah, although I don't find them, obviously, I don't find them incompatible, but I would definitely be interested in somebody who could, you know, map the ways in which they are congruent, because it's something I could say I've lived it, to the extent I've lived it, but I haven't had to sort of work it out as yet. I mean, in this conversation, it certainly gave me an opportunity to try.